A little idle chatter about the people that we know. And though it doesn't matter, is there a different way of saying hello?
You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit www.questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hi, this is Meg Riley here in Columbia, Missouri today. While we work to bring our special guest Bobby Allison on, I would invite our regulars and our guest host regulars to introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Aisha Hauser, and I'm in Seattle, Washington.
And hi, I'm Michael Tino, and I'm here in Peekskill, New York.
It's good and to behind be- the, behind that chalice, we have Lori. Whose last name I've just completely blocked. Thank you. Can you tell I've been on sabbatical for a month? I have total sabbatical brain. I was saying to Michael and Aisha that on my mind is that Thomas Jefferson, well, what did I miss? So I hear that you guys held down the fort wonderfully in my absence. Michael, thanks for being here.
You're very welcome.
Yay. Bobby Allison, how fabulous to see you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Sorry you had technical difficulties. And thanks to Lori Stone Sertowski for heroically getting you here.
Right.
So, Bobby, where are you exactly?
I'm in Kirkland, Washington.
Kirkland, okay. Aisha lives near you.
Right.
I'm in Seattle. I work at East Shore. I'm in Seattle, Washington.
Yeah, I know that about you. Hi.
Oh, good.
Well, because Bobby's been a religious educator, among other things. Bobby Allison, we've invited here as the daughter of Monroe Husbands, probably the most successful evangelical ticket writer in, I'll put him up there with the Iowa Sisterhood anyway, really helped to start more than 400 of our congregations. And so we've asked her to talk about that. But Bobby, you also have done amazing things yourself. Why don't you share a little bit about your own life and what you've done with Unitarian Universalism, because it's not nothing. As we, before we talk about your dad, let's hear just a little bit about you.
Well, I was born into the religion. I was born Unitarian and grew up with Sophia Lyon Foss in the Sunday school and started with AUY and then LRY. Then went to Antioch College, and after that, at one point, I was RE director for 1 year in Columbus, Ohio, and then RE director in Honolulu. Let me see, I did that for 7 or 8 years. And then the last job I had connected with UUs was with the UU Service Committee. So I was there in the 90s.
Yeah, so you are an organizer yourself. First of all, I always say every religious educator is a community organizer, because if you couldn't organize the community, there would be kids without adults there and it would be big trouble. It wouldn't just be like a bad sermon. It would be big trouble. Aisha is wondering if you knew the Obama's grandparents when you were in Honolulu.
Obama was in our Sunday school, but none of us remember him. It's so embarrassing. But the minister, the minister's wife, my kids that were in the classes, and you know, my son is close to his age, and there's no recollection.
Yikes.
Well, I went to college with Steve Jobs and thought he was a total loser. So, what can you say? So we wanted to talk about your dad, Monroe Husbands, and his, how many years did he serve at the UUA? 19 years. Mm-hmm. So I went to see Bobby when I was out in Washington last year. I know I mentioned it on the show. And I had pictured her saying to me, my dad was gone all the time. I had a miserable childhood. He was out there working 100% of the time, because I had tried to figure out how this man managed to do this work. But Bobby, that isn't the story you told me at all. Can you describe how he did the traveling that led to the founding of all these congregations? How he worked, how he set that up?
Well, he worked closely with the Church of the Larger Fellowship. He would find that there would be several people in a certain location, and he'd start.
How would he find that? How would he find that there
through, was through the CLF records?
So we'd call CLF to find out.
Well, they're right there in the same.
Yeah,
he was actually clerk of CLF at the same time. And so that would give him access to all the records. And so then he would begin contacting people in different places. And I'm sure he gave them a bit of a talk about the potential of this. They were already Unitarians at the time.
You know what, Bobby, I realized I didn't ask a really important question. What 19 years was this? When are we talking about? When did he do this?
This was from 1948 to 1967.
Thanks.
Okay, so then with these contacts, he'd start arranging a journey from Boston to California and back. And every single night he would stop at a different place that had already been set up with these contacts. That also included advertising, and the Are You a Unitarian and Don't Know It was part of that. That was the beginning of that kind of advertising.
Michael's holding something up because he is the minister at one of the
I didn't see it.
That was started through this way. Bob, why don't you say where you are and when it started?
The advertisement that he placed in the local paper in Mount Cisco, New York, March of 1957, for his talk on Tuesday, March 26th, 1957. And that this advertisement helped found the congregation that I serve now.
We're
going to put a picture of that up on the chat for people watching The View to see. Up closer, but it starts off with, who are these Unitarians?
I remember that.
Yeah, I dug some stuff out of our congregation's archives that Laurie will post on the public chat for people to see him founding the congregation in Mount Kisco. But please go on.
Please go on. So he'd have the core group of people. And he'd use paid media, right? And then he'd gather for just one night with people.
Yeah, just one meeting. But of course, there'd been a lot of communications back and forth with some of them beforehand. This would take between 4 to 6 weeks, and he'd do it twice a year. So at the meetings, he would talk. He loves Unitarianism and now UUism with the merger, but he's very passionate about the religion. And so he's got acting training. So he was really good at putting the ideas across, and people were really delighted. He was also very good at identifying who were potential leaders. So at the end of the evening, if they, and they always did, want to try and start a group, he would name temporary officers at that time. You know, so there was president and so on. And then knowing that once they were organized, they could do their own democratic election. But he really was able to peg the people that were going to be good at following through and organizing and building this up.
Did he have a great secretary? That's what I wondered after we met. I was like, did he have a fabulous administrative help? Because all of those letters, which must, I hope, be digitalized somewhere, because it's such important history, that back and forth to get to this point, right? Did he do that alone or did somebody help him? Do you know?
He had one secretary. It was the two of them in the office in Boston. Well, over time, it was a different person. But the first person and the one who was there the longest, he thought she was terrific. So, yes, he did have a great secretary.
We who know how things actually get done, right? Without that strong administrative backbone, it all falls apart. The grandest speaker doesn't matter. So he would go out twice a year, and he would speak for one night at, so you're saying 30 to 40 places, is that right? And the same, and just once to each place. He didn't go back to the same places again.
On an ensuing trip, he might drop in on one that's already established, but primarily he spent his time with new potential groups.
And after he did that, was there someone else at the AUA, UUA, who supported that group in any way, or were they just kind of out there?
He did
all the support.
Right.
Wow.
Right. He worked with others on staff. He worked with Sophia Lyon Foss to develop a RE curriculum. It was always his belief that if the group did not have an RE program, it was not going to be sustainable. And so he encouraged them to have a strong RE program.
It's interesting, Bobby. There in the materials that I have, there's an article on this congregation being formed the night that he came to speak with them, and it says he there were temporary leaders, just like you said, that were selected at that meeting, and there was an RE committee.
So very good.
They named the temporary board and the members of the RE committee. So it's like exactly what you were saying, that he left there.
That's awesome.
He left there knowing that they had a board and an RE committee, which is really awesome.
That is really awesome. So he did this for 19 years. I mean, he took over the mantle from, forgive me, I just came off of a month sabbatical and I have no mind for names right now, but another guy had helped to start this up whose name I'm blanking right now, right?
Well, was Lon Ray Call.
That's who I'm trying to say, yeah.
And he had been interested in forming fellowships for a number of years and, in fact, did set up a couple of societies on his own, I think mostly in this area, in Washington.
He started East Shore. He was East Shore's first called minister.
Uh-huh. And what was a very personal, tender thing is when I came up here, moved up here, I found in the Woodinville Church Lon Ray Call's daughter. And so I had a chance to visit with her. She has died since, but that was so wonderful. The two daughters talking about their fathers, and he was, her dad was away a lot, and she may have given you the same story that you were expecting, Meg. And so finally he got AUA to pay attention and to get serious about doing this, but he had the whole vision of how this would operate, and then Dad stepped in and did it.
So your dad was hired specifically to do this, like it had been designed, and he came in and made it his own and
right
with it, pretty much.
Right.
And at the time, it was part of the AUA's extension, or
yeah,
it was part of the AUA.
It was AUA Department of Extension, right? Yeah. Dad was the department once he got going.
So amazing. And some of those congregations now are flourishing and some of them have died, but it's certainly the most successful model we have of planting congregations. What do you think we could learn from it now? Like if you could wave a wand or influence incoming possible presidents, what would you say to them that could be relevant now from what you watched then?
Oh, I have no idea. I have to ponder that a little bit.
Well, I think you have a pretty good idea because you've really laid out the pieces of it. that you need to identify a group of people, and then you need to communicate with them, and you need to communicate with passion and purpose and power, and then you need to put some people in place to do the key work that needs to be done in order for it to move forward. You've said okay. All that, Bobby.
Okay. Yeah. Well, he started about 600 societies. So I would say almost half the congregations of our current UUA have fellowship roots, which is a lot.
Yeah, the number I've heard is 440. So I'd be really curious. It would be just so important to lift up this shared history, which CLF kind of holds as ours, even though, as you say, at the time we were separate and supportive, but not really doing the same work. But we certainly claim him at the CLF. You know.
Well, because he was clerk of CLF for a long time.
He was very involved.
It was very
CLF.
Integrated. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wonder if maybe George Marshall or other people at the CLF were also supporting this.
And I wonder, what it would look like today, not to give you more work, Meg, but what it would look like today if the CLF were to look at its membership and say, wherever there were 50 people in a metropolitan area with no congregation, that someone should go there. Not someone necessarily from the CLF, but someone from the UUA maybe should go there and try and, you know, make them into a congregation. When I look at this article, there were 40 people at the meeting that Monroe Husbands had in Mount Kisco. And that wasn't just from an ad. That was from him calling and knowing. And there were probably 30 members of the CLF who lived in the area, and they invited friends, and the ad probably got a couple more people to that meeting.
Yeah. But, and now we have tools like Meetup. I mean, people like Tandy Rogers do this. We should have asked Tandy, because she's the person I know most back when she was on district staff, which she is again, but now it's not district. But she would call CLF, get the names of people in different areas in the Northwest, meet with them, and get them connected to each other quite often, and provide resourcing. And maybe other people are doing that too, and I don't know about it. But Tandy's the one that I know who really, another religious educator, let's just say it, who really took it and moved it forward. I've hit the road. I feel like there's real possibility, especially in this crazy polarized political climate we're in, which, you know, I think of 1950s, and my own parents found Unitarian Universalism during the McCarthy era, when they were desperate to be with people they could talk to about what they saw going on in Texas, you know. And my dad says my mom went to church and he stayed home with the kids, and she came home and said the service was fine, but coffee hour. And so I feel like, uh-oh, we just lost Bobby. Uh-oh, hopefully she'll come back. Isn't she great?
She's great. One of the things I noticed about the story is how less rigid the idea of who was a leader in the 50s, right? He came in. He pinpointed who would be responsible and follow through. President, RE committee, done. And I feel like there's such bureaucracy right now. You do that. I think, Meg, I've experienced you. I say it all the time. I've experienced you as saying, here's a ministry that needs to happen. How can we support it? Black Lives of UU. I mean, definitely. I've seen you do that. I don't see the UUA doing that. And it's unfortunate, because I think there's a missed opportunity. And I feel like for such a progressive faith, I put that in quotes, we are incredibly unimaginative when it comes to leadership as a whole. And that's disappointing for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think in a way, and this isn't a criticism, I worked at the UUA for 21 years, but we all get into our paths and go. And I think in a way the UUA hasn't taken social media seriously in terms of what it means to do what they do now. Because it used to be they were the only people who could convene people. But now all you have to do is start a Facebook group for this or that. And you've convened who, and you can ask directly who you want to talk to. So that opens capacity for the UUA to do something really different, I think. which I'm not really seeing being taken advantage of as much as it could be. It'll be interesting to see what kind of visions the candidates put forward for how leadership could be different, you know, in this time. And Michael, you guys must have talked about that on the presidential search committee, I'm thinking.
You know, we didn't talk like specific policies about growth. And
no, not policies, but just general.
All the people that we put forward, we needed to be fluent in social media in a way that, like, even if they said, boy, I don't know how to do all these things, but I know people who do, and they will be on my team. So we needed them to at least say that for us to take them seriously. So I think we've got three candidates who, if they don't know all the ins and outs of social media, know who they need to have on.
Oh, yeah, they shouldn't be doing it themselves. My God, the president. But yeah, I'm just talking about a vision for what leadership could be, and looking at what two people were able to do with not as much support as we might wish coming from the whole organization at the time.
Well, and I think it would be interesting. Hopefully Bobby will come back, because I'd love to talk more about the support that was given to those congregations. I mean, it sounds like, I mean, if he turned their RE committees over to Sophia Foss, I mean, it's not like they were left in the wind. Come on now, I'm sure that she was supporting the development of their RE programs and sending them curricula and all sorts of stuff, right? So, you know, I feel like it takes some same support. Oh, good, Bobby's back.
Oh, we're glad you're back.
Sorry.
Michael was just raising a question that maybe we can move right to. Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, so we got to talking in your brief absence about what kind of sustained support these new congregations did or did not have. And, you know, you mentioned that he worked closely with Sophia Foss, for example, and believed that these congregations should have RE programs. So my guess is that she was supporting their RE committees and supporting their RE programs. Is that a bad guess? Or, I mean, did she just like send them a pamphlet once and be done with it? I doubt it.
he provided everything. And what he provided was developed by staff at UUA. And so there would be different kinds of resources that would get developed over time. And he would get them to all of these groups, either deliver them on the day that he speaks to them. He drove a Willys Jeepster, and the back of it was loaded with paper as he drove across the country. And he didn't come home with anything. And so he handed these out. And then there was a lot of mail correspondence afterwards where they would send things. My memory's a little fuzzy. I think that they, but I think I'm confusing it with CLF, that there were Sunday morning ideas. Now that was CLF that did that.
But I think CLF provided materials for those small congregations with the church in the box.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right. So there would be things on administration and every aspect of fellowship life that he'd have little pamphlets and brochures that would offer suggestions to congregate the new groups, the fellowships.
So was the staff at the AUA and then the UUA lined up behind this? Like, did he feel like he was just kind of out there on his own, or did he feel like he was really the front of something much larger coming from the whole movement? Do you know, did he talk about that? Did he feel unsupported, supported, neutral?
Well,
people are dead now. You can be honest.
I think he was supported. I think everybody who did things from their own expertise to offer to the fellowships were happy to help in that endeavor. So I think he did feel that way. I heard a lot at the dinner table, but I didn't ever hear any complaints about that kind of thing.
Bobby, do you know how many of the fellowships, like what's the largest that you know of? Like, did any grow to 1,000? Did he start the one in Tulsa? I'm curious to see where they, you know, what's the biggest one? Are there records that would indicate that?
I don't have that information.
Each church would have its own records. I don't even know that we have a list of all of the congregations that were started through this.
I think we do. There was actually a book that was published.
It was a book.
On it, yeah. Listed them. I know that, so I became a Unitarian Universalist at the Eno River Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Durham, North Carolina. And both the fellowship in Durham and the fellowship in Raleigh down the road were started by Monroe husbands. And at the time I was there, they both had more than 500 members. And Eno River was in the 600 to 700 range when I was there. I don't have no idea how many members they have right now.
Eno River still over 550 because they're part of Smalloc.
Right.
So Raleigh not. But.
So there's at least one official large congregation that was among the fellowships he started.
I think a lot of mid-sized congregations are in this group. You know, so my parents became Unitarian down in Houston and an established church, and then they moved up to Charleston, West Virginia, where there wasn't one in 1956-7, and helped to start one. I don't have the records Michael has, but I'm sure they exist. And they did everything. You know, they had summer interns, but that was it for ministerial leadership for a long time. And Kayla Parker's there now. Mel and Rose were there for a number of years. They've turned into a full-fledged congregation. Some of them, I know, people can get really down on the fellowships because they're intractable and, you know, kind of small, clubby places that don't want to grow and become flourishing for the wider community. Was that an issue then? Did he see trends in the kinds of congregations that gathered, or did he? They must have been too new to really even be able to know at that point.
I never heard anything like that. What I heard mostly was excitement. And I know that he always had lists. He had his big map behind that on the wall where he put the pins in. And he also had lists. So they must have them recorded somewhere of all of those that got started.
Yeah, Michael, thanks for reminding me of that book. I read it when it came out and forgot about it. We should promote that. I'm sure it's for sale at the UUA bookstore.
What is it called?
Oh, I was going to get it out and I forgot.
I think it's called The Fellowship Movement, but I'll look it up. We'll get a link on our site.
The first one was Bright Galaxy, and that's out of print, and not many people have copies of it anymore.
I don't know that. What is Bright Galaxy?
Yeah, that's the first one that was written, and it was written while he was still working. So it didn't have the full story, but it told a lot about how people would meet in funeral parlors, and, you know, they'd just grab anywhere that they could find to have a meeting place. And a lot of them were original and creative. So it tells a lot of the stories of the beginnings.
So you were one of a number of kids, right?
I had one brother.
One brother. So were the two of you caught up in these stories? Did you feel like it was kind of like what he was doing was exciting for you too? Or was it more like, oh, dad's work?
Well, I picked up on his energy because he just loved it and was so pleased with all he was doing. It was such a privilege for him to be able to use his skills in this way. And so I felt that I had, you know, I was kind of young back in 48 and the beginning times. Oh, there's something put up there. So I wouldn't have understood the politics of it. And, you know, I wouldn't have heard that at the dinner table.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard a lot since.
Yeah,
but I kind of think the fellowship movement has done a lot in terms of lay ministry. I mean, I see our church life has changed quite a bit since that, since before and after. With the expansion of the fellowships around that, in that time, we changed from May meetings every May for the annual meeting to meetings around the country. So Boston wasn't so central anymore. You know, there were a lot of little things that were big things that changed that I think were, the fellowship movement had some influence there.
Well, that's interesting. I've never thought about the May meeting change. Interesting. I wanted to lift up that Katie Cartman shared that All Souls Tulsa, which I know Aisha named just because it's a large congregation. I think you pulled it from the air, but it was founded in 1921. So I don't think, Aisha, you really did think it was founded in the 50s or anything.
No,
but
I just don't.
But just to clarify.
Dead words, that's all.
It was not part of this movement. It has its own interesting history. Bobby, when you were at the service committee and you were doing, what were you working on there? You were doing congregational organizing of its own kind, weren't you?
It was my job to find a volunteer in every congregation that would be the advocate for the service committee. And I provided some material. So I was the one who put together the guests at your table materials and things like that. And so I'd be recruiting the ministers and the RE directors and all to prepare materials for that.
Another successful organizing endeavor of Unitarian Universalism. Guests at your table, though I know counting those, the change is annoying, was a really successful program. And I'm betting you used a lot of the same skills that your father did to do that work.
Well, I felt a little bit in his footsteps in that job, partly because I was communicating with people all over that in all the churches. And of course, in finding, I'd have to be in touch with ministers in order to help find the right person to be the advocate in for the service committee. And so I'd be working with a lot of different people of the church.
That's great. Lori from Behind the Chalice has just said that on the CLFUU Facebook page, you can find both the photos that Michael shared from the founding of his congregation and the map of the fellowships that Bobby mentioned. Oh my gosh, Lori made a slideshow. Woo! Very impressive, Lori. Thank you. So, Bobby, he was there through a number of presidents, I know, right? I'm trying to remember UUA history this way. So,
Frederick May Elliott was first.
Okay, so this came out of Frederick May Elliott was the one who was there when was being developed and envisioned and imagined. Yeah. And then who were the, over those 19 years, who were there?
Oh, gosh, I don't remember the chronology.
Michael might know. He's Mr. UUA. But it would have been a number of them.
I can look it up while we're talking.
Let's just say there would have been a lot of them, and probably that's all we need to know for who we are. But I'm just, you know, I think one of the things that's interesting about the UUA governance as it is that, which is true for the U.S. too, is that the new president always comes in with new priorities, and then the whole staff does a shift. The bigger the staff, the slower the shift, of course. But this program ended, is what I'm thinking. Correct? This program, he ran it. Nobody picked it up when he left.
True.
Right. So it did not. And I wonder why it wasn't. It was so successful. I wonder why it was stopped. And do you have any ideas about that?
Well, Dana Greeley was president then. I think there were financial issues at UUA. And I remember Dad talking about coming home and saying, somebody got fired today. And this would happen from time to time. within a small period. And then he got fired. And so and that closed the program. So I suspect that it was primarily a financial decision.
Yeah.
The it got harder. I mean, it was very easy in the beginning to get a lot of fellowships. So if you look at the numbers per year, you'll find that as the years went by, he didn't have as many new fellowships as he did in the beginning. And in the beginning, he knew to go to a lot of prime spots like college and university towns. And so the most potential places of that time were already taken. So they may have, that I doubt if that would make a big difference because he was still bringing in enough new fellowships, but it was
that's
slower.
Interesting. That makes total sense, right? There would just be a lot more to start with. And as the years went on, it would get hard. Anything would. And it's not like programs should never end just because they're successful. I just wondered if there was any thought about how that would evolve, because it kind of feels like since then we've kind of been floundering with what we do to start new congregations. There hasn't been anything as sustained or as successful as this since then. Aisha's wondering, what did he do after leaving the UUA? I know he stayed at CLF for a while.
Well, he stayed at CLF as a volunteer and was volunteer clerk. And George Marshall was very supportive and glad to have him there. He was in his mid to late 50s. I don't know when he lost the job. So for 19 years having the same job, it was hard for him to figure out where his skills would be useful, where to take them. And he applied to a number of things, I think, but he didn't find the right thing. And he became a mail clerk down in the industrial center in Needham, Massachusetts. And he was very happy to have a job. A lot of us were very sad because he was a man full of pride and of an era where it was important to support his family. And so he had to work and he would do whatever it was. You know, the pride didn't get in the way of what his work was. The pride was in taking care of his family. So he was very happy to do what he was doing.
That is so sad to picture. And if do you mind if I share the other really painful thing that you told me when we met? Because it really stuck with me. But
No, I don't mind.
So he was there for 19 years. This was a time when the UUA had pensions. And Dana McLean Greeley fired him right before he would have gotten a pension. So he got no pension. Which I just found, Dana McLean Greeley's dead. I'm sure it was a tough time, but I find that unforgivable after what he gave to the movement. That really stuck with me after you told me that. I feel like so many decisions are made without understanding how they impact living people and families. And they're made all the time in the bigger world. I like the Unitarian world to behave differently. So anyway, that was the only sad thing that you really told me when we met. And I told it to one person who knows presidents well, who said he could be a mean SOB. So I don't know him. The guy's dead, but I feel like that was a really inhumane choice that he made there.
Well, and no, Dad wasn't the only one fired, and I'm sure that other people were affected as well.
Yes, I'm sure they were, and you could figure out with a pension how to make that not happen that way. Mm. You know, it's been done. And I have to say, that in my time at the UUA, I saw many more humane decisions made than that. I did not see that kind of behavior. Of course, none of us have pensions anymore, so it's a different time, right? We all rely on the stock market now. So what do you feel like is the legacy that you see alive from the work that he did? Because you've looked at it nationally, you've been in Honolulu, you've been in Ohio, now you're in Washington, like, where do you see it and think, oh, people don't know, but there's my dad still alive?
Oh, well, it's certainly in all those fellowships and churches that have evolved. And as I mentioned, I think the empowering of the lay people, that I understand from some ministers, it's not always comfortable, but I think the churches that I'm in where there's strong lay leadership is working closely with the minister are the most vibrant churches.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll say this, I'm the minister at CLF, but I also visit a lot of churches and go to church, sit in a pew. And you don't join a minister, you join a community. Mm-hmm. Secret. We don't go for the sermons, we go for the humanity. And to the extent that the people are happy and full of their own usefulness and power, it's a vibrant community. And you're right. The negative ones are where the community and the community is trying to diminish the minister. That's not good.
That's
for
not cool. No.
That's just not going to work. People will flee from that instinctively. But the ones where they're lifting each other up, that's the magic. That's the magic place.
Right.
And it's wonderful. It is. I don't know. I think about your dad a lot. I feel like he's I loved that you told me he had studied acting and he loved to kind of be really big and dramatic about our story. Cause I feel like kind of culturally we can be so like repressed, and I love the idea that it was a really vibrant, flamboyant, I picture him, but just somebody really kind of who was really, and I see it in you, Bobby, really full of life and that's what actually lit the fire under, I think I'm going to claim that as legacy. I wasn't there. I get to make it up, right?
I sent Lori a couple of photographs of his that he had done for publicity.
Oh, good. And that's part of the slideshow, I bet,
probably,
that Lori's made for
probably.
Us. That's great.
Yeah.
Michael, how do you see this alive in your congregation now, this founding story?
I mean, certainly the legacy of strong lay leadership is still there, and I love it as a minister. I'm in my 10th year as the minister here in Mount Kisco, and I love that there are strong lay leaders who take ownership over the congregation and understand that that it's their congregation in a really profound way. I love that. So I was talking with some colleagues yesterday about a group that's doing some stuff in my congregation, and they asked me a detail. What it is not important. But they said, they asked me about a detail of their work. And I said, I have no idea that group will give its report to the board in December. And, they've involved me in the work. They're not ignoring me and my input as the minister, but I don't know all the details of what they're finding out, and I'll find out when the board finds out in December, which is, it's freeing that I don't have to worry about that. I can trust this group to do what they're good at and give us this report. And so that's part of that legacy. I also think that things get baked into congregational DNA early when they're founded. And I think that if a group is founded with a sense of exuberance about the possibility of Unitarian Universalism, that stays in the DNA of a congregation. That, and from what I've read about how he founded the congregation I serve, the people who he tapped as leaders were really clear that, that Unitarianism at that point had promise and was a good thing, and that, that gathering in Unitarian religious community was a benefit both for people and for the community, right? And so that's what got baked into the DNA, that what we're doing together is a good thing. You know, educating our children to be moral agents in a complicated society is fundamentally a good thing, that we are participating in saving the world. And he might not have used that language, and they might not have used that language in 1957, but I use that language today and see it as part of that legacy, that they understood they were doing something good. And I don't have to convince my folks that we're doing something good today, which, you know, if you know Unitarian Universalists, you know, some of us have to be convinced that, like, we have something to shout from the rooftops. He shouted from the rooftops and had no qualms about that, and bless him for it.
And let's lift up that he was not an ordained minister shouting from the rooftops. Part of his legacy was as a lay leader, empowering lay leaders. Bobby, what did he love about Unitarianism when he talked about it?
Well, he was a humanist, and coming out of a Mormon family, and was thrilled, as a lot of the people he worked with, that a lot of the people who joined the fellowships, he was thrilled with the having a liberal humanist religion as a sustenance. And I forgot the question, but what it led me to was whenever I would go to different churches back, it doesn't happen now because most of those fellowship founders aren't living anymore, but I would find people who would want to come up to me and say, "Your dad changed my life," because they were so lonely in their religious world, and to discover this. And that's what was important to Dad. I mean, he in Salt Lake City, when he found Ed Wilson's church, and Ed Wilson was one of the founders of the Humanist Association, he was just so delighted to find a religion that honored the human being and the potential of the human being and the responsibilities of the human being. Yeah.
Well, amen to that. It's been such a blessing to have you here and bring your dad. I feel him, you know, I feel him.
And he was, AUA deliberately chose a layperson for this job. They considered both and concluded that for lay-led groups, they wanted a layperson. So it was a deliberate choice.
That is fascinating. That's really interesting. Because, you know, Tandy, I was mentioning Tandy Rogers, was not yet ordained when she was really doing that work. And it's interesting to think about how to make that happen. It's, I wish we'd started that part of it earlier. But great to talk to you. It's wonderful to
see. It's my privilege. Thank you.
I think I had dinner at that table with you. And maybe you'll get to see Aisha in person. She's one of these
organizer
types now. So yeah. The two of you together, it's a little scary to think what you might do. Yay, in a good
Looking
way.
Looking forward to meeting you.
Me too, Aisha.
All right, thanks so much. Next week we'll have some folks who have been at Standing Rock who've come back to tell us about what they saw and experienced there. And Michael, you're going to come back next week, or is this your last week with us?
I'll be back next week.
Oh, good. Yay.
I think I like this.
All right.
Oh, good.
Glad to meet you, Michael.
Thanks so much.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.